There's a lot of building going on in Park City these days, both new construction and a lot of renovations. And there is a new supervisor for it all. David Thacker is the new chief building official. David, did I say that right?
That is correct, yes.
Chief building official. He's in studio, as you might have guessed. Thanks for being here, David.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
So, first off, you're returning to town. You worked here before from 2007 till 2012 as a building inspector. Tell us why you left and what brought you back.
Sure. So I did. I worked as a building inspector and also as a plans examiner. So I kind of got the full effect of what went on out in the city and also the plans that were coming through and was able to take a part in all of that. The reason I left was mainly for a great opportunity to kind of grow my career. Learn what there was outside of the state of Utah. My most of my public sector experience had been within the state. This opportunity, you know, just seemed to fit well with my education, my background, would give me a great opportunity to really experience something other than what I had. So I took a chance and was offered an opportunity to move to Boulder, city of Boulder, Colorado, where I was the building services manager and chief building official for 5 years. And, you know, always knew that it was a great place to be, very beautiful part of the country, but making the connection with that and home was always a challenge for me. And so the opportunity to come back to Park City was definitely appealing and something that I'd always wanted to do. And so I'm really grateful that I have the opportunity to be here once again and to be able to work with this wonderful community.
And you were in Wasatch County too, right, prior
Correct.
To Park City?
Yeah, so To give the whole story, my actual career started here in Park City in 2002. So my very first inspecting experience after I got my first certification to be an inspector was in Park City. I worked here for 2 years from 02 to the middle of 04, so almost 2 years. Then I did go for 3 years in Wasatch County. And the reason behind that was I was finishing up my schooling. And so the scheduling worked really well. And then once my schooling was complete, I was able to solidify an opportunity again here with the city. So this is actually my third opportunity to work for the city. I'm really grateful to be back.
You keep coming back.
I do. Yeah, it's a great place.
So tell us about your experience in Boulder, Colorado. What was it like for you there? What do you hope to maybe replicate here in Park City? And what did you see in Boulder that you thought, heck no, I never want to do that again?
Sure. You know, Boulder's a great place. It's very, very similar to Park City in a lot of ways. There's a lot of community involvement, a lot of collaboration with the community. The city council there, similar to here, very involved in the events. And, you know, so it's a really great place. And I learned a lot while I was there. Population is definitely different. So the volume and the number of maybe customer concerns or citizen complaints that came in were things that we worked on much more because there was a higher volume just due to the population. So those were some of the things I really learned. What I wouldn't want to see or wouldn't want to bring back, I think, is a hard question to answer because there are as many similarities as there are still our differences. But I think the one thing I do want to bring back is just my drive for customer service and customer collaboration, because I think as we work together in the building industry, whether it be in a plan review, through code enforcement, or through building inspection, the ultimate goal for both sides, whether it be a contractor, inspector, or city staff, is to really get to that end product that's safe and complete for the customer. And so as we work together, I really just want to bring back the opportunity to work together and not be a roadblock, but be a resource to the community.
So, customer interface.
Yeah.
This gets right to the list of questions
awesome.
I have for you from all my friends out there who are architects and engineers.
Great.
Okay, so the first question, interface with applicants. Availability for over-the-counter permits for smaller jobs has been severely restricted. Would you perhaps assign someone to handle the counter exclusively on this?
That's a great question and something I'm definitely looking at a little bit closer personally. You know, as I come back in, I don't want to jump in and make these immediate changes that I'm hearing need to be made. I'd like to really experience and kind of get a feel for what we need on both sides, for the customer side and for the staff interaction. One of the things that we did do well in Boulder that I really liked is there was a what we call the services center, which allowed customers to come in, and it had an expert or a service area expert, I guess would be the best way to say that, from engineering, planning, and building that were able to answer questions and to issue some over-the-counter with limitations, of course, but it was all kind of a one-stop shop we have a very good hybrid of that on the in park at the, sorry, I was going to call it Park Central, that's the old building, at the Muni building here. But how we can maybe look at that and possibly integrate it differently is something that I'm definitely evaluating.
City Manager Diane Foster and the budget guy Jed Briggs are coming in next, so we can ask them to give you an increase in personnel.
There you go.
I'm sure they'll go along with
yeah,
that.
Yeah, sure they will.
Okay, so back to customer service, and I understand that you don't want to make changes right away,
sure.
But along those lines of customer service, how long do you believe it should take to receive a building permit? And it is currently a notoriously long process. What can you do to improve that and reduce the time frames? Does that kind of go in line with your service center idea?
It kind of does to a degree. There are permits that need to be brought in. There are a lot of reviews that need to be done. I think the one of the things that I realized when I left Park City in 2012, you know, our review timelines were roughly, we tried to keep it within a 10-day window. We didn't always make that due to volume, due to staffing, et cetera. But we did the best we could. As I left here and went to Boulder, I was very shocked and surprised to see that their actual review times were up to 40 days. And that was business days, not just days. So very different timelines. And so I tried to really break down what that looked like. And the reality was, it was just a way to, you know, as people looked at things, it's a way to queue up permits for reviews that took that much longer. So as I was there in Boulder, we started with small steps. So we went from a 40-day, we backed that up to a 26. So we almost cut that in half. And our next step that they'll be taking soon, so this is over time, as you can see, but the next step they'll be taking soon is to back that 26-day down to a 15-day. So we're really trying to get that down so that it is ratcheted and we can really streamline our review process. And how I want to look at things here is very similar. What are the things that are holding us back from getting our reviews on time? Is it volume? And if so, how do we work through that? Is it staffing levels? And if so, how do we, you know, not necessarily, you know, as you mentioned, how do we talk to Diane to get more staff? I don't think that's the solution always, but how we work differently at a staff level to maybe make things streamline a little bit faster.
Now, along those lines, I understand the integration of planning and engineering department reviews don't seem to be coordinated very efficiently, especially engineering. So what can be done to align those review times between those departments? How do you coordinate better with those guys?
You know, and that's always a challenge. And similar to the answer I gave before with Boulder, we had them integrated. We have subject matter experts. I can't speak to how that's going to work specifically here. As you mentioned, I did come back on Monday, so I'm really trying to get my feet wet. And as I keep my floaties on and swim in the deep end, I'm really trying to just get a grasp of how things are working now. I mean, it hasn't changed immensely from 5 years ago, but at the same time, I've got to get a better feel and forget what I've learned, not necessarily all of it, but and just get back up to speed with the Park City way, and then I can really evaluate how we can make those streamlines and enhancements.
So a really good point. Your first day was Monday, May 8th.
It was Monday, May 8th.
So when you talk about maybe, you know, you want to sit back, you want to get the lay of the land.
Right.
Do you have a timeline? Did when you were pitching this job, did you say, hey, I anticipate in 6 months and a year, X, Y, Z will happen? What were those?
Yes. So as far as something I pitched to the city with a timeline, not necessarily this is what I'm going to do. But for me personally, I do have a 6-month timeline that I'd really like to have a really better feel for what's going on and also start to look at how we can work together as a team to really continue to give great customer service. I think there's a great deal going on, and everyone working for the city is really giving their best right now to provide for our customers. I just really like to, you know, bring in that outside kind of view and share maybe some ways that we can just, and it's not even enhancing, but work differently and just work together in a different manner to really help our customers.
Great. Well, we have you on the record. You have a 6-month timeline, so we'll bring you back here on November 11th.
Yep, I look forward to it, and I hope to share some good news at that time, too.
We hope to hear it. That's great. Will you also be accepting the role as fire marshal for the city as well?
Yes, I will.
Okay.
Well, let me take that back. So the role is actually fire code official, so I'll be over the fire marshal, Kurt. I knew I would say that. Kurt Simister is continuing to be the fire marshal, but I'll be working directly with him.
What do you anticipate being the future enforcement of the Wildland Urban Interface Code, which encourages a defensible space around structures, essentially no trees within 30 feet of a building? That would make Park City look kind of naked.
It would, and, you know, it's something that we worked with in the city of Boulder as well. And for those that have been in the city of Boulder or who haven't, there's a huge canopy there of beautiful silver maples and just really, really beautiful tall trees. And as it's mostly an infill community, there's not a lot of new builds going on, so you've got to scrape an older home to build a new one. And so with that comes a concern of how we work within the lot that we're given and build a home and also preserve those trees, because nobody wants to, you know, the story that I always would hear is, well, I want to rebuild on this lot because I inherited it from my ancestors and my great grandpa Johnny planted this tree 100 and, you know, however many years ago, and now it's beautiful. And the Wildland Urban Interface does, you know, some in certain areas, it can contradict where you can build a home. And so with a scrape and a new build, obviously there are ways we can work around that and we can situate the home or maybe design differently. If it's an existing structure and we're looking at some defensible space, there are ways to work through the Wildland Urban Interface Code. I think that there are things that I'd like to look at and explore. I will be working with Kurt. We actually had a briefing yesterday where we started talking about this a little bit. We're going to continue to work with the Park City Fire District. We're going to work with officials from the state to really boil down how we can make this work and what kind of methods we can use so that it doesn't look like, you know, the defensible space is all we're going for. We still want to preserve the landscape that we have and make it beautiful, continue to keep it beautiful as well.
And we don't want the fires that Boulder has seen.
We definitely don't want the fires that Boulder has seen. Fortunately, the fires have been mostly limited to outside of the city itself and in wildland areas, so structures were not compromised. The Wildland Urban Interface Code was in effect in Boulder, and it did save some structures. So there is some value to having that. That said, I think there are also ways that we can consider some other fire protective measures, such as fire sprinklers, such as some minimizing defensible space requirements that would help out in getting that code up and going that would make sense for the community.
The city has an ambitious goal, net zero goal. What is your experience with sustainable building approaches and the incorporation of alternative energy solutions in both residence and commercial buildings?
Great question. So the city of Boulder, similar to Park City, they have very aggressive goals, and they do have a net zero goal as well. Their net zero goal is to be net zero by 2031. And so as the city of Boulder has been working through their energy codes, it's been, I've been alongside some consultants and other staff members working directly with how we can incorporate that into the built environment. You know, some of the numbers that were run with our consultants' help out there was, you know, roughly 20 to 30% of the energy usage or the carbon footprint, if you will, was related to new construction. And so how we're able to really mitigate that going in is important. And so I need to change my thinking. The city of Boulder really looked at the energy code and how it would work to get to net zero. And so for residential, the city of Boulder is currently implementing 30% above a 2012 energy code, which is a little bit more aggressive than the energy code the state of Utah has, being the 2015 code. And with that, there were also some specific requirements. There was an individual code that was adopted by the city called Green Building Green Points. And what that did is in addition to the increased energy code requirements, there were specific areas that you had to meet measures. So, for example, it would be deconstruction and recycling of construction materials. Another one is, a HERS rating or an ERI, which is an energy rating index, which really you go in and you measure your home for its energy efficiency and you get a score. And so there were certain criteria you had to meet in order to get that score. And once you did, you were considered to be compliant with the code. And so I'd like to really kind of bring some of that thinking back. And that's for residences, of course. Commercial building was very similar. But I'd really like to bring some of those ideas back, understanding that the energy code is a state-adopted code. It's really something that I'd like to see how we can work differently within the city.
That's David Thacker, Park City's new chief building official. Thank you for being here this morning. We have Diane and Jed outside, and we're going to bring them in. Thanks for being here. Welcome back to town.
Thank you.
We've got a lot of news to cover with Park City City Council. Joining me this morning is City Manager Diane Foster and Budget Operations and Strategic Planning Manager Jed Briggs. Welcome, you guys. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, I'm going to start with brass tacks here, Jed. The fiscal year 2018 budget that you guys are going to be talking about on Thursday is increasing to $67.1 million. That's an over 7% increase from last year's adjusted budget. Why the increase?
So a lot of things going on. We have, you know, we're talking about the operating budget, which is my specialty, which is what I like to talk about. There's always kind of the usual suspects, health insurance increases, pay plan adjustments. But the biggest thing really that we're dealing with right now is an increase in transit services, and that's countywide. That takes up the lion's share of that 7.2% that we're adding routes, adding infrastructure, and that's all being funded with the new countywide sales tax. So that's where we're really going to be adding more kind of personnel, bus drivers, buses, and that type of thing.
I noticed that it shows, the new budget shows an 11% increase in personnel. And is that, what are we talking about when we talk about transit? We're talking about bus drivers. Are we talking about the parking, the new parking structure we're putting in place as well?
There is a parking and transit are in the same fund. We call it the transit fund. So there is a few new positions in terms of like parking personnel as well. But most of that is bus drivers and a couple of other kind of admin type of positions, like a marketing position and that type of thing.
Diane, is it standard to have about a 7% increase from year to year?
You know, if you look at the general fund, there's a 4.5% increase, and that is functionally an artificial limit that the city council and city staff have agreed upon. And because our sales tax increases every year generally exceed that. In another city, what they would normally do is whatever they got for increases, they would spend the next year. And we don't take that approach. We actually try to put a lot of money into the capital fund. In fact, we have an unusually large capital fund compared to our general fund. And we actually put together, Jed runs a process as well as on the Jed on the operating side and then Nate Rockwood on the capital side. They run a rigorous process that puts a lot of things through the ringer. And so if you look at the things that were requested, and generally we don't see frivolous position requests, et cetera. We see things that, that department managers look and say, I really need this. I really need these positions. And staff is not recommending that we fund all of the ones that people feel like they really need. So what we're doing is we do limit ourselves. The hiring of approximately 20 bus drivers is quite unusual and is, as Jed said, specifically associated. We really appreciate that the taxpayers supported the county's two tax increases. And so on the transit side, it really is increasing service.
And so, Jed, what was most challenging for you in terms of the operating budget?
Well, if we're looking at, you know, just the general fund, we get a lot of requests from department managers, and we had $1.7 million in requests this year, and we could do about $600,000. So whittling that down and saying, hey, we're willing to do this and not do this can be really tough for a lot of managers that are asking for funds because they all make a good argument that they need that funding. And we have a committee called the results team that looks at all of those requests and says whether or not, you know, we want to recommend that or not recommend that. And we base that process off what we call budgeting for outcomes. And that process is really tied to our strategic plan and our critical priorities that we set up during the council retreat in February when we look at council's goals and priorities and say, this is where we want to be allocating resources based off of where the needs are at. And so that really helps kind of guide the process. But it is a difficult process with, you know, with the managers and with staff that are asking for things that they feel like they need.
So personnel costs are your biggest increase from year to year, it sounds
like. Yeah, that's right. On the operating side, yeah.
Okay. Anything going down significantly?
No, but I will say health insurance increases are always there. Mm-hmm. Usually they're double-digit increases, but this year we're looking at about 4 or 5% increase over last year, which is really nice for us because we're always anticipating this big increase, but it came in less than we had anticipated, so that was nice.
Adjusted capital budgets seem high, but it says that's because there are some carry forward items from last year. What are those?
There are things that happen in the capital budget are different. In the general fund, we don't have any carry forward. And generally, there are projects that go from year to year. And so we budget for those and then carry those things forward. Things like Main Street sidewalks is a good example of we've been taking a stepwise approach to that one. And I should say also that the city employs about 4 or 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, the city started using a process called budgeting for outcomes. And Jed and Nate were really involved in this is a cutting edge, and there aren't, a lot of cities just do incremental budgeting. And this one, as Jed pointed out, looks very much at what outcomes does council want to see and then budgets for specifically achieving those outcomes.
Jed, you look like you had something to add there.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that in terms of the carry forward, unlike the operating budget where we budget every year, it's like a brand new budget every fiscal year. The capital budget is, spaced out over several years. And so anytime that we don't spend that money, that leftover surplus gets carried forward. And so that's why that number is so big, because we can't, we don't keep it in the previous fiscal years. We just carry that to the next year. So it's always this big chunk moving forward with the budget process.
Yeah, carry forward from 2016 is $70.6 million, and it looks like it's from 2016 almost $178 million. Mm-hmm. So those are expensive projects, but...
They're big and expensive projects, and I will say Matt Twombly brought in the project on the barn, the structural piece on the barn, and that actually came in under budget. And so that money got carried forward as well.
Anything else about the budget you guys think is important for our listeners to hear before we move on with the rest of the agenda?
The only thing I wanted to add was that, the economy's doing well, and we are looking at sales tax increases over last year, and that really helps, when we're trying to budget out for our expenses for the next years. We're projecting out those sales taxes, but the economy is doing well. We had a really good ski season. And, as long as those things are happening, that makes our jobs and lives a little bit easier.
Moving on, the work session. Convention sales license, Diane. It says, last winter there was some confusion regarding convention sales license and the difference between public facilities and private facilities and how that affected the type of license needed. What type of changes is the staff recommending to simplify this process?
Staff is recommending three different adjustments to the convention sales license process. One is just providing council with more information about when folks are coming in. This is specifically related to the film festival. A lot of times, Sundance gets their stuff in on time. They get it in early. A lot of the folks who Sundance considers ambushers, folks who aren't associated with the festival but are coming here because they can get good advertising off of it, a lot of times we'll have things come in late and they'll request, 3 days before the festival, they'll ask for a special city council meeting to have something approved. And staff has bent over backwards to communicate with these folks, and we want to provide council with a little more transparency on that front about how much we've actually done with each one of these. So council can look at it and say, hey, are these folks just taking us for a ride? The second piece is that... the load in and load out is a lot of times a big challenge, especially when you have like somebody loading out on day three of the festival. It's really disruptive to the community. So staff is recommending that we require people to have a minimum stay of 5 days in a facility and that we coordinate the load out so we have a little bit less disruption. The third type is that when you have something like a Silly Market or a Women's Business Network who are having these kind of holiday bazaars, that you can do one license that will cover everybody there instead of having to do a individual license for everyone for a single day event.
Then in the consent agenda, there is going to be a discussion about hiring an events planner, essentially, for the 4th of July celebration. The city was told back in 2015 that the Park City Ambassadors would no longer be hosting and providing that event. You also had some concerns from residents and staff regarding challenges regarding the growth and impacts of the 4th of July. You heard the event had lost some of the fun, funk, and community feeling, according to the staff report. So you think hiring an event planner will help solve this problem?
I think this is nothing short of brilliant. The ambassadors were great. They're a fantastic group of people. A lot of them still in the community, although they don't run the event anymore. A lot of them are still involved. Joel Fine's still involved in the event, and a lot of the other volunteers. at the end of the day, though, it was a no one owns it now. And, you know, I think you even saw it in the Follies this year, them saying, you know, oh, you can run the 4th of July parade. So it was a hot potato. And last year, Steph did a lot of work to make sure the 4th of July went over well. They also worked a lot. We got a lot of great feedback from SEAC and made a lot of improvements last year, both to the transit, how transit ran that day, as well as things like moving the moving games and things like that from the smaller side of City Park where the pavilion is over to the side where the rugby teams used to play, moved rugby out to Quinn's Junction, and now, and all of a sudden, you know, tents popped up along the, along, and people would line the edge of the field with tents, and it just ended up being so much, so much of an improvement. So staff will look to make improvements, but the idea that we're not the ones who are kind of organizing the guts of the parade, our role is supposed to be regulatory, not the promoter of the event. And we do want to separate those roles and have it be a separate organization.
And then a short-term lease for Mountain Trails Foundation. We're Park City. We love our trails. This is a group that does a lot of work for the city, a pretty good cost-benefit analysis. So you guys are going to give them some space?
Right. And the idea is that they can have some space that they can store things that they use for the work that they do on the trails. And that would be out of staff recommendation is store those out at Quinn's Junction.
Bonanza Flat, there's going to be a discussion about a new resolution about placing a conservation easement on Bonanza Flat if the city is successful in purchasing the property. You have heard from other cities that say, we will donate, but we kind of want to see some uses on the land. Like, can you guarantee us there's going to be hunting and snowmobiles and ATVs? And so people, you know, you're asking people to donate money. They want to make sure they can use the land the way they want to use it. Sounds like you guys are going to make it a little more clear.
This one actually is a little bit less related to what the uses are going to be. As you heard from Councilmember Tim Henney a few weeks ago, that is something that's going to be done once we close on the property. This one was specifically because there were some donors who said, are they definitely going to put a conservation easement on the property? And there's no question that the city will put a conservation easement on that property. And so this is simply to state that publicly in a very public way and have council physically vote on a resolution that says, yes, we're going to do this.
And finally, because we're running out of time, the Central Park condos in the Prospector area, the city is looking at spending $4.3 million to purchase these 11 units and then turn them around. Anne Laurent told me yesterday to sell at below market rate, but City Council, that discussion it may change to renting. In your opinion, what's the best way to go with this property?
Sale or rent is definitely a City Council decision. The City Council historically has wanted to sell properties because they want them to be people who are going to be here year-round and here for the long term. The other argument is we definitely want to, if you can reduce the number of people who are driving into town for work, as you heard Tom Fisher talk about yesterday, then you can reduce the amount of traffic. So there are good arguments for both. I think this is an incredibly exciting project, you know, adding 11 units. If anyone thought that City Council wasn't serious about this 800-unit goal, I think this is great evidence of that, as well as 14 units coming up from that are have gone into play for Park City Heights that are already, and then we've got another 8 units at 1450, 1460 that you see going up right now. The Woodside Park Phase 1, that will be starting this summer. That's another 13 units. And then Woodside Park Phase 2, another 55 units. So we are making progress on this.
Great. Diane Foster, City Manager for Park City, and Jed Briggs, Budget Operations and Strategic Planning Manager. Thanks for being here this morning. Joining me this morning is Alyssa Mitchell. She's a healthcare educator with the Summit County Health Department. Good morning, Alyssa.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. So Safe Kids USA, it's a nationwide network of organizations working to prevent unintentional childhood injury, which is the leading cause of death and disability for kids age 1 to 14. On your website, it says injuries aren't accidents. What do you mean by that?
Well, so I think what we mean by that is injuries can be preventable. So, for example, wearing a helmet while you're riding a bike is a way to protect yourself if you do fall off your bike from injuring your head. So if you don't wear a helmet and you fall, you'll injure your head, but there's common knowledge out there to wear a helmet. So that's what we're trying to say, is there's ways to prevent these injuries that we're seeing. And so we're trying to educate people on how to do that.
So that mantra of kids will be kids and they'll have accidents, the message is to parents, there are things you can do to prevent that from happening.
Exactly, yes.
And so let's talk about Safe Kids Day. When is it?
So it'll be May 19th, which is next Friday from 1 to 3:30 at Parley's Park Elementary. But all kids in all the elementary schools around Park City are welcome to come. I know we'll have some of the after-school programs joining us as well, and it'll go from 1 to 3:30. And we have a variety of different partners that'll be attending the event to talk about different safety topics.
And so parents can come with their kids, and parents might pick up some good tips while they're there.
Yes, we'll have handouts for the parents. Kids can be fitted for bike helmets. We'll provide, I know one of our partners, the fire department, will work with kids and parents to help create like a fire safety plan. So in case there's a fire at their house, everybody knows how to get out of the house safely. We'll do a bike rodeo. Our sheriff's department will work with kids, teach them how to ride their bikes on the road safely, which is good for parents to know as well. Because you have to ride your bike pretty much the same way as you would drive a car. You have to, when you come up to a stop sign, you have to come to a stop. When you cross a crosswalk, you get off your bike. And so this is good information for parents to even know.
And a bike rodeo?
Yes. It's a term we use. So basically, we set up a little obstacle course. And in this course, we'll have like traffic signs that kids have to obey. We'll have a crosswalk that kids will have to look both ways before going across the street with their bikes. It's really just a lot of fun. And we'll also be giving, along with that bike rodeo, we'll be fitting kids for bike helmets who need one.
Now, here's a tricky question. I noticed on the website a lot of injuries to kids are from firearms. Will you have anything related to firearm safety at this day?
Not at this particular event. We do a lot of our firearm safety information with our Suicide Prevention Coalition, but we do have available at the health department gun locks. So if parents are interested in getting a gun lock along with a brochure, we recommend stopping by and coming and getting a free one. And also just with other gun safety tips as well, we encourage people to keep them locked and keep the ammunition and the gun separate from each other. Those are just different ways parents can prevent it.
And seatbelt safety and child seat especially. I know those are challenging for parents to install them the right way. Will you have someone there talking about that?
We will. Primary Children's Hospital will be there. They'll be talking about seatbelt safety and booster seat safety as well. One of the biggest problems we see here in Summit County is kids move out of the booster seats far too soon, and so they're too small sitting in a regular seatbelt, which is actually made for adults like you and me. And so Primary Children's will have the opportunity to have kids try out. They have a measuring stick, and they'll measure kids, see how tall they are. We recommend kids be 4 feet 9 inches tall before they graduate from their booster seat. And so they'll be able to tell a child, you still need a booster seat, or you can try and move to the seatbelt. We'll work with parents as well to show them how to properly buckle in their car seats as well and answer any questions related to that.
Anything else you want to add about Safe Kids Day?
We will. So again, everybody's welcome to come. And I would really like to take this time just to thank our partners involved with this. We received donations for prizes from kids from Storm Cycles, Deer Valley, The Mark, Silver Mountain Sports Club, the Utah Olympic Park, Mike Hill Chevrolet, and Basin Recreation. So kids, when they come, not only are they going to learn the safety information, they'll have the opportunity to win prizes as well. So it's going to be really fun. I encourage everybody to come out. And again, it's from 1 to 3:30 on May 19th at Parley's Park Elementary.
Everything's free.
Everything's free, yes.
Great. And one last reminder to all our listeners out there, a recent news article, good news about our health in Summit County. We live longer than other Utah residents. I saw that. Our average is 81, and I guess the Utah average is 77 years old. So that's great. But the bad news was our melanoma rate is the highest.
We do have high melanoma rates. We're actually the highest in the state, and Utah as a whole is one of the highest in the country. We flip back and forth between, I want to say, Vermont, but part of that problem too is because we're at such a high elevation here in Summit County, and also we're outdoorsy. We've got all these beautiful trails and mountains that we can go have fun in, and in eastern Summit County we have our ranchers and kids who are out on their ATVs, so because we're outside so much at high elevation, we're more exposed to the sun, so please wear your sunscreen.
Good reminder. Alyssa Mitchell, a health educator with Summit County Health Department. Safe Kids Day, May 19th, Friday, 1 to 3:30, Parley's Park Elementary. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time is 8:56. This Saturday night, there will be a Fork in the Road in Park City. That's the name of the fundraiser for Eats Park City. EAT stands for Eat Awesome Things at School. Joining me in studio this morning is the executive director of EAT, Ann Bloomquist. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about this event. I went last year. It was great.
Oh, you did. Awesome. Yeah, and this year is going to be bigger and better. This year it's at the Legacy Lodge right at the base of Park City Mountain. It's from 6:30 to 9:30, and it is sponsored by the Vail Epic Promise. Thank you very much, Vail. This year, our chef, Alec Malmberg, has pulled out all the stops on a fabulous six-station gourmet food. We'll have a seafood raw bar, a salmon plank bar, beef tenderloin bar, a salad shaker bar, another vegetarian bar, something for everyone. We'll have past hors d'oeuvres with tamarind, soy, quail, satay. I mean, it's really going to be top line. Hey, if Eats is in your name, you know the food is going to be good. So we invite everyone to come out. We have fabulous silent auction, which have over 150 items. We have 33 of our local restaurants participating in that. So, again, it's all about food experiences. We've got lots of chefs that have volunteered to come to your home and cook dinners, cooking classes, experiences like the Interconnect and rafting on the Weaver River, spa certificates, concert tickets, all kinds of things. And one of the coolest things we're going to do is we have the 50 Shades of Gourmet. It's a live auction where we'll have four local chefs, very notable chefs, come up on stage, and the participants can bid on them to come to their home and cook them a five-course gourmet meal. We've got John Merko from Firewood, Clement Gelas from Telesker, Jody Rogers from Deer Valley, and our own Alex Malmberg from Vail Park City. So it should be just fabulous. There'll be food, music, photo booths, mystery lunch bags that the kids from Miss Deneen's class at McPollin's Kindergarten have decorated for us. And you could buy one of those and see what's inside. And a giving garden and just all kinds of fun.
The gift bag from last year was wonderful. How much are tickets?
Tickets are $100. You can go to our website, eatsparkcity.org, to get them. And also, I want to put a plug in for our opportunity drawing this year. We have a trip for two to Napa Valley for a wine experience. It includes airfare, car rental, two nights hotel in exclusive places, and four VIP tours at different wineries up there. It's going to be a fabulous prize. Tickets are only $25 each. You do not have to be present to win. So you can go on our website and buy those tickets as well. So that is a fabulous trip.
So even if you can't make the fundraiser, you can still participate in that drawing for $25 a ticket.
Exactly.
That's a great prize.
And support Eats.
Now, let's remind our listeners what Eats does.
Okay, Eats is an Eat Awesome Things at School. We work with the school district to do two things. We advocate for better school food offerings. And this year, due to those efforts, the Child Nutrition Services has implemented 10 new menu items throughout all our schools, which is fabulous. And we have also then the other thing that we do is the nutrition education around those menu items to tell kids why they should be eating that. So we do the taste tests of those new items. In fact, we have one today where we're doing a strawberry chicken salad, which is a recipe that the lunch ladies themselves came up with, which is wonderful. And Eats will be at all the schools today having kids taste that, and the kids can vote on whether or not they want that on their menu.
So parents, when you say to your kids, how was school today, you can say, how was the strawberry chicken salad today?
That's right. That's right. And watch for those menu items so then they can eat during them. And we also have school gardens and cooking classes that we do for our child nutrition services.
So thank you, Ann Eats. Fork in the Road fundraiser this Saturday night at Park City Legacy Lodge. Go to eatsparkcity.org for more information. Ann Bloomquist, thanks for being here.
Thank you.